this universe. We are in this universe. The universe itself exists within us. We are part of this universe. We are in this universe. The universe is in us. Yes, the universe is in us.
Every atom in your body came from a star that exploded. You are all stardust. You are all stardust. From a star that exploded.
Look up at the night sky. We are part of it. The universe itself exists within us.
We are stardust in the highest exalted way. Called by the universe. Reaching out to the universe.
We are stardust in the highest exalted way.
Reaching out to the universe. With these methods and tools of science.
Stand in the middle and enjoy everything both ways. The tininess of us and the enormity of the universe.
The atoms that make up the human body are traceable, to the crucible that cooked like elements into heavy elements. These stars went unstable in their later years, and then exploded, scattering their enriched guts across the galaxy.
Look up at the night sky. We are part of it. The universe itself exists within us.
We are stardust in the highest exalted way. Called by the universe,
reaching out
to the universe. We are stardust in the highest exalted way,
reaching out
to the universe with these methods and tools of science. We are stardust
in the highest exalted way,
reaching out.
The universe itself exists within us.
All right, let's go ahead and get started. Welcome all. Thank you all for coming. Good afternoon. How's your afternoon going? Good? Awesome. That wasn't very enthusiastic, but I'll trust you. Okay, so I know there's people trickling in, but it's time to start. So for those of you who don't know me, my name is Scott Schnall. I'm a principal technical writer on the Exchange team, and I'm super excited to be here talking about one of my favorite topics, which is high availability and site resilience for Exchange 2013. I'm particularly excited, not just because I've been working on this feature set for the last several years, but also because you're one of the first audiences in the world to hear what I'm about to say for the next 75 minutes. So consider yourself among the elite few who are about to learn about some of the new features that we have for the very first time. So, as with all the Exchange presentations, because it's pre-release software, I have to disclaim the deck. Basically, everything that I'm saying is about pre-release software, so features could change, screenshots could change, performance characteristics could change, et cetera, et cetera. Now, that being said, I don't expect anything I'm about to tell you to change. I expect all of this to be in the RTM version and beyond, but of course, since it's pre-release, I can't guarantee that for you. Now, our agenda is pretty straightforward. How many of you were in the architecture deep dive earlier this morning? All right, almost all of you. So if you were already in that session, you already have some pretty good information that's telling you how much better things are with respect to Exchange 2013 overall. But what I'm going to tell you is how the story around storage, around high availability, and around site resilience have also gotten much better in Exchange 2013. How many of you are on 2010 today? How many of you are on 2007? Anybody earlier? Few people, okay? How many of you are running highly available mailbox servers today? A DAG, a CCR, single copy cluster, that kind of stuff. Great, excellent, great audience. Okay, so I'm going to start by first talking about the storage features that we have. Because we only have 75 minutes and because there's so much new stuff in all three areas, I don't have time to tell you about every single feature that we have. So there will be stuff left over for you to go and learn about in the documentation. But I am hitting all the high points, particularly with respect to storage and site resilience. HA, there's a lot of stuff that I wasn't able to cover in there, but storage and site resilience, I'm really just hitting the high points. So with storage, what have we done there? We've done a lot of work there. We've got a new feature I'm going to tell you about called multiple databases for volume. And a companion feature that goes along with that called auto reseed. That's one of those brand new features that really not too many people know about, including those folks who are in our pre-release technology adoption program. They don't know about it because even though the code is checked into the preview that you can all download, we didn't yet document that feature, so we didn't really tell them about it. So you are really one of a select few of a very small group of people who are hearing about the auto reseed feature for the first time. But the build didn't come up right, so let me get auto reseed up there. So the other features are automatic recovery from storage failures. That is continuing some behaviors that we introduced in Exchange 2010 and enhancing them for new scenarios. And then we've also done some work around lag copies to enhance your use of those and basically make them easier to activate and leverage. So let's talk about the first one, multiple databases per volume. Now I want to tell you that every feature I'm going to describe from the storage aspect is largely designed for JBOD environments because it's specifically addressing challenges that we see in those environments, that we see, for example, in Office 365, which is all JBOD. But that being said, every single feature I'm going to talk about is supported on all Exchange-supported storage. So if you're not using JBOD, if you're using RAID, or if you've got SAN or some sort of non-JBOD configuration, you can use all of these features. But you'll start to see how they sort of shine more in a JBOD environment because they're addressing specific deficiencies. Multiple databases for volume is one of those areas where we are addressing inefficiencies at the hardware level. So what does that look like? What am I talking about when I say multiple databases for volume? Well, when we talk about a volume, we mean a disk volume. A single disk with one partition on it being called a volume. And on that volume are more than one databases, each in their own individual folders. So one folder for each database, one folder for each log stream for each database as well. And what that looks like is what you see here, a very symmetrical design. This is one example. It's a four-member DAG, and it's got four databases, and we've got four copies of each database. And you get four databases per volume in this symmetrical design. And I'll talk about how the number of database copies relates to the number of databases per volume that you're going to use. And you've got a very symmetrical design here. And it's also balanced not just in terms of the number of active and passive copies, but it's also balanced in terms of activation preference as well. So we still have the concept of balancing a DAG that we introduced in 2010, but now we're able to do it with a slightly different design. So why do we have this? And the number of database copies equals the number of copies for volume as well. That's a restriction that we have, and I'll explain why that is in a moment. But why do we have this? What are some of the challenges we're trying to solve with this type of architecture? Well, one of the challenges refers to database sizes. They have to be manageable. Now, those of you on 2010, you know that our maximum recommended database size, if you are replicating your database, is 2 terabytes. We don't recommend growing over 2 terabytes because things get a little tricky from an operational standpoint. If you have to reseed that database, or if you're still using the old school backup paradigm, if you have to backup and restore that database, that could take a really long time. So we have to keep databases size reasonably manageable. But reseeds also have to be fast as well. That's yet another reason to keep the sizes down. Obviously, the smaller the database, the more quickly you can reseed it, and the more integrity you should expect of it going over the network as well. Some of the other challenges, though, is that capacity from a disk perspective is increasing, but the amount of IOPS that we get are not. In fact, the amount of IOPS and the rotations of disks are going to be largely fixed throughout my lifetime and throughout your lifetime as well, possibly throughout the lifetime of your children. It's actually the laws of physics that are preventing us from going further. We don't have any materials that we can spin faster than 15,000 RPM. And we don't have any mechanism whereby we can power something to spin faster than 15,000 RPM. So because of that, until those two breakthroughs happen, which again, I don't think are going to happen in our children's lifetime, we're going to be bound with capacity increasing, but IOPS staying the same. We also had this issue, I don't know if you could call it an issue or an architectural discrepancy with respect to the passive database copy in Exchange 2010. And the discrepancy is when you look at the amount of workload that each type of copy is doing, an active versus a passive, well, the passive copy, which has no direct user activity against it, turns out it's about equal in IOPS to the active copy, which does have user activity. Part of that has to do with the architecture of 2010. Part of it has to do with the fact that we used a very low checkpoint depth so that we could get fast failover. Part of it also has to do with some of the aggressive pre-reading that the passive copy does to maintain integrity and to keep moving forward and so forth. But either way, we've done some work to address that to reduce the IOPS. And then also, when you're using a lag copy, which is a special kind of passive copy, now you've got asymmetrical storage designs that you have to deal with as well. You don't have a nice symmetrical balance because anytime you're using a copy that has a truncation lag time or a replay lag time configured, it's going to impact your storage design. And it's going to mean that those copies have different storage requirements from a regular active and a non-lagged passive copy. And in the Exchange 2010 world, you have generally low flexibility when it comes to running out of disk space. If you're in a JBOD environment and you're running out of disk space in an Exchange 2010 environment, about the best you can do to get yourself some breathing room is to simply throw away the content index. Now, yes, that will impact the search experience. Obviously, we won't have an index to search again, but users will still be in the system, and that will then give you breathing room in order to do something to alleviate the constraints that you're in. So how do we solve that? Well, the way we solved it is this feature called multiple databases for volume. And it doesn't make maybe a lot of sense with today's hardware, where many of you are still using 1 and 2 terabyte drives, but 3 and 4 terabyte drives are available. And next year, by this time, you'll have 8 terabyte drives available. So now you've got new hardware sort of going up against the maximum database size recommendations from the Exchange team. So say, for instance, you decide to deploy an 8 terabyte drive. That's what you've standardized on. Well, knowing that our maximum database size is 2 terabytes, when you factor in things like the log stream and the overhead from the content index catalog, a 2 terabyte database on an 8 terabyte drive is basically wasting 5.5 terabytes worth of disk space. Tremendous waste. We wouldn't ever want you to do that. Of course, the opposite side doesn't make things any better as well. You know, and that would be to grow beyond the 2 terabyte limit and grow perhaps as large as 8 terabytes, or go and fill up that disk. You bought the disk, you want to use the storage, so you want to fill it up with the data. And you have certain challenges with this. So here we have a 4-server DAG, and here this is a model where we're using 1 database per volume, which is the model that we use in Exchange 2010. Only in this case, instead of having 2 terabyte drives, we've got 8 terabyte drives in the system. So when I lose one of the copies, obviously, that's not just a disk failure in a JBOD environment. Every disk failure is also a database failure. And it will require a reseed operation to get that database back. So now I need to reseed. If I'm reseeding, in this case, 1 database, I'm effectively source bound. There's a single source here, and I'm going to get about 20 megabytes per second worth of throughput. That's all things being equal in terms of storage and network. Now, if that database is 2 terabytes, it's going to take me about 23 hours to complete that reseed operation. If I grow the database beyond 2 terabytes, I want to fill up the disk and I grow it to 8 terabytes, well, now I'm looking at a reseed operation that is really operationally untenable. We're looking at about 93 hours to reseed about 8 terabytes worth of data. That is not a position that you want to be in, taking that long of time just to reseed 1 database copy, not to mention all the challenges with transmitting that type of large data set over the network as well. So what do we have? We have a feature whereby you put multiple databases on the same volume. So instead of 1 large 8 terabyte database, you might look at this as 4 2 terabyte databases. or about 1.5 terabytes when you remove the overhead from the logs and the content index. And now in this case, obviously it's a very similar scenario. If we lose that disk, it's a database failure affecting all of those database copies. And yes, we have to do a reseed operation. But in this case, we are reseeding multiple copies, and we're reseeding them from multiple sources. We're not source-bound because we are able to seed from more than one server. So what I end up getting once I replace that disk is much better aggregate throughput. For the servers that only have one source that we're using, I'm getting the full 20 megabytes per second throughput. For the servers, for example, server 4, where I have to seed two copies from that same source server, I get about half the throughput from each of them, or about 12 to 15 megabytes per second. But the aggregate is much faster. At this rate, I can reseed just a single 2-terabyte database in about 9.7 hours. And because I'm reseeding four databases from, in this case, three separate sources, two of which are giving me full throughput, I can now reseed an 8-terabyte drive that's carved into these 1.5 or 2-terabyte chunks in about 39 hours instead. So it's a much more operationally reasonable type of solution. And one thing that makes this super exciting is it gives you the opportunity to leverage this new hardware while at the same time also being able to add capacity to that same system as well. It's a very exciting proposition when you're getting the less expensive, newer hardware and you get to increase the workload on it as well. It's a huge win. But there's more. This is just the reseed benefits that you get. If we extend the scenario even further, and we think about the reductions that we've done with respect to the passive copy, how it's now equal to about 50% IOPS from the active copy, thereby lending itself to having multiple passive copies on the same spindle as an active copy, things start getting a lot much better. And in fact, what you end up having with this is this combination of changes that we've done inside of ESE, inside the storage engine and whatnot, that really help reduce IOPS, and they reduce failover times as well. You're looking at failover times about half of what they were in Exchange 2010. And we already see that in our own production environments. In our corporate environment, where we're still running Exchange 2010, we see about 20-second failover times. In our dog food environment, where we're running Exchange 2013, we see about 10-second failover times. So we're already seeing this fast failover, this half failover times in our own production environments. But what's beautiful about this is because we've reduced the IOPS so much, and the aggregate, again, using this example of four databases per volume, you end up with about 25% more IOPS per spindle than you'd have without going down this model. And it gets better, because now we're looking at the best case scenario. Even if we were to move forward and look at the worst case scenario, where you've lost two out of these four servers, because of the reduction in IOPS and because you have the ability to store multiple databases on the same volume, even in the worst case failure scenario, where half of the DAG is gone and the other half is now being serviced by the surviving members, you're still only at about 25% disk utilization, 25 to 50%, depending on how many databases you go. So there's still room left over to breathe in terms of IOPS, in terms of capacity, and in terms of your ability to onboard more users. So it's a huge, huge win for you. Now, some of the other things that we did, I've already mentioned this one, the passive I/O equals the active I/O in Exchange 2010. In 2013, passive I/O is about 15% or half the I/O of the active copy. Another change that we made is that aggressive pre-reading that the passive copy does in 2010 to keep up and give us that low checkpoint depth and that fast failover as a result of that, we don't need that anymore. We've made significant changes to the architecture such that the checkpoint depth is now up at 100 megabytes for each of the passive copies. So now actives and passives are both at 100 megabyte checkpoint depth. But because we've rewritten ESE logging, the transaction log mechanism, so that we can now preserve the cache when we do a failover, we no longer need the passive copy to do this aggressive pre-reading anymore, and so it doesn't. We've detuned it for that, and that's resulted in a reduction in IOPS on the passive copy. And then the last thing that we did around this area was look at background database maintenance. So this is something that would normally run, and it's particularly important in a JBOD environment because anytime that you encounter a bad block, you're going to have to deal with some sort of page corruption and have the system fix it up. And background database maintenance is the mechanism that would go in and look for those bad blocks. And in 2010, in part because we didn't have a wealth of experience that told us what the annual failure rate was going to be for drives we were using, what the instances of bad blocks were going to be in the drives we were using, we actually had background database maintenance running fairly aggressively. It was about 5 megabytes per second per copy. Now in 2013, based on the bad block experience that we now have in Office 365, where it turns out the rate of incidents is much lower than we originally expected, we're able to throttle back BDM and tune it down to about 1 megabyte per copy per second. So right there is a 20% reduction in the workload, again, which translates into a significant IOPS reduction for Exchange 2013. Now, the requirements, there's two requirements. It's always going to be one single partition per disk. So when we talk about multiple databases for volume, that's not, in this example, 4 different partitions. It's one partition with 4 different directories under that. The other requirement is the number of database copies that you have has to be equal to the number of copies per volume. So if I decide to make 4 copies of my databases in a DAG, and I want to use multiple databases per volume, I'm also going to be storing 4 database copies per volume. Okay, that's just a requirement that we have. It does make things nice and symmetrical for you, but it does also mean some extra planning needs to go into play. Now, there are scenarios where if not every copy or if not every database has the same number of copies, things will still work, except the next feature I'm going to talk about won't work for you. The next feature, auto reseed, requires that you have this symmetry. It requires that the number of copies per database matches the number of databases per volume that you're storing. Now, in terms of best practices, we like having the same neighbors on all servers. You saw in the original drawing where we had DB1, DB2, DB3, and DB4 on each server. That makes things very easy from a manageability standpoint. That makes things very easy from a hardware efficiency standpoint. That makes things very easy from a provisioning standpoint as well. The other best practice is to, just like you would in a 2010 DAG, balance the activation preferences. And by balance, we mean that the sum total of the activation preference for all the database copies on the servers is equal across each server. Okay, pretty simple stuff. Now, it plays in very well to another feature called auto reseed or automatic reseed. Now, you don't need to be using multiple databases per volume in order to use auto reseed. But if you are using multiple databases per volume, in order for auto reseed to work, the number of databases per volume must be the same for all database copies, and it must equal the number of copies of the databases that you have. So, auto reseed has its own challenges that we're solving. Again, designed for a JBOD environment, when you have a disk failure of the active copy in a JBOD environment, that's a database failure, and that translates into a database failover. When one of those failures happens, that's got to be addressed right away. You know, the disk may need to be replaced, it's got to get reseeded so you've got another healthy copy in its place, and someone's got to do something. And then you also need fast recovery to restore redundancy. It could be that that disk failure that just happened has now let you into a state that we call a single copy state, where you're down to just one healthy copy of a given replicated database. And in that state, it's very, very important that the administrator act on that right away. So the idea behind auto reseed is to use spare disks that the administrator's pre-provisioned and placed in the system. And once they've done that and they've configured a few properties of the DAG, the idea is when one of these failures happens, the system will recognize that, grab one of those spare disks, initialize it, get it ready to be a host for the copy, and then automatically reseed the data from the failed databases. So the idea is what normally would be an operator-driven activity, or in the case of on-premises, an administrator-driven activity, that is now something that the system will do for you. So how does it work? Well, I've got my DAG member here, the one, big one in the middle, and it has a pool of storage. It's got its in-use storage. These are the volumes up at the top. And then it's provisioned with a few spares. Three in this example. It could be one spare in your environment, two or three. It depends on what your needs are. The point is you don't need one spare for every disk that you have in the box. You just need a couple spares. So what happens is we lose that disk. And by losing, I mean one of two things. Either the disk goes away from the operating system standpoint, or we cannot write to the disk from an ESC standpoint. If either of those two things happen and auto receipt is configured, auto receipt will do its thing. Otherwise, if it's a flaky disk where sometimes we can write to it, sometimes we can't, auto receipt doesn't do anything. It is only there when the disk is presumed dead, and dead from the operating system standpoint or dead from ESE standpoint. So that disk dies, and what happens is the auto receipt's configured, so auto receipt will take one of the disks that's in the spare pool, and it will automatically set that up as the new replacement disk, and it will kick off a reseed operation from one of the other places that has a copy of the database, and it will reseed that disk with that data. Once that's done, in this case, remember, anytime we use auto reseed, it's because the original disk is dead. The original disk simply gets released. Doesn't go back into the storage pool, it's just released from an Exchange and OS perspective, and then it'd be up to the administrator to go pull the dead disk and put in a brand new one or replace the spare that was provisioned. So how do you configure it? Or how does it work, rather? So the way it works is auto receipt, once it's configured, it will start scanning periodically for database copies that are in a failed and suspended state. Failed and suspended being the indicator that there's something seriously wrong with this database copy and we can't write to it. Again, maybe because the drive went away from the OS, or there's so much corruption that ESE can't write to it. If we find something, we'll do some prerequisite checks, make sure that there's a spare volume available, check to see if we're in a single copy condition, and if we pass all the checks, we'll go ahead and take one of those spares and we'll allocate it and remap it using Windows mount points, and I'll show you the mount point structure in a minute. Once we've done that, we'll start the seed operation, and when the seed operation is complete, we'll verify that it's healthy, and once we verify that it's healthy, we release the drive, which again is going to be a dead drive, so it's up to the administrator to pull it and put in a new replacement drive. So, how do you configure it? Well, you configure it ideally as you're building the DAG. Now, this is a feature that can be used for a DAG that already exists, but it's going to involve invoking mount points, changing database paths, and so forth. And those of you who are running DAGs right now, you know it can be a little bit difficult and kind of a challenge to change database paths for replicated databases. So in an ideal world, you will be setting auto reseed up ahead of time as you build the DAG. So you'll configure the storage system with the spare disks. Again, you don't need very many. Just to give you an example, in Office 365, most of the servers that we run have, I think, 35 in-use disks in them, all JBOD configuration. And I believe we've got about three spares in each server, and we're trying to reduce that down to two. So again, you only need a very small number of spares here. You create the DAG, you add the servers to the DAG, the ones that have this configured storage. You create a directory and mount point structure, which I'll show you in a minute. Then you configure the DAG, and there's three new properties that you configure, and I'll tell you about those in a minute. And then you create your mailbox databases and your database copies. It's that simple. So here's what it looks like from that. The two properties, one is autodag volumes root folder path. That's the path where you tell the DAG where to find the Exchange storage, the volumes that hold the existing storage, and where are the volumes that you're using for spares. The other is the autodag databases root folder path, and that is there so that you can tell Exchange where the root of your databases is. So under the root, you will have one directory, one for volumes, one for databases, and under those directories, you'll have either mounted folders or subdirectories for the databases and log files. So for instance, under the volume folder, I've got three volumes rather that I've mounted under here. The red lines indicate the mount points. Two of them are going to host databases. Volume 3 is going to be my spare. And then you can see under EXCHDBs, under the database path, I'm also using two more mount points. So those of you who are used to using mount points in Windows, you probably have clued in to what we're doing here. We are leveraging Windows' ability to use multiple mount points that point to the same location. And we're using that so that we can give it two different pieces of information about that location. Where's the storage and where's the databases? The last piece of information we tell it is how many copies per volume that you have. So you can see that's how the DAG knows how many database copies to expect. And it's here where if the number of database copies that you have per database, that must match the number of databases per volume that you're using. If it doesn't match, auto-reseed will assert and it will not work for you. We have a requirement that they must match. If they do match, auto-reseed will work beautifully. If they don't match, auto-reseed will not work for you. It is a requirement that we have them matching. All right. Let's talk about automatic recovery from storage failures. This is not entirely new behavior. This is behavior we introduced in Exchange 2010, in part as a recognition of the fact there are simply some storage errors that are unrecoverable except for a forced reboot of the server. Okay, there's just some ways or some scenarios in which there's only one way around it. Something's got to reboot the server. So thinking of the case of a storage controller, for example, most storage controllers, modern ones these days, they're mini PCs. They can crash, they can hang, they can cause hung I/O, which from an Exchange database perspective is a very, very bad thing. So we had these mechanisms inside of Exchange 2010 to take this recovery action if we hit any of these thresholds. So for instance, ESE database hung I/O. Okay, if we can't write to an ESE database within 240 seconds, we will trigger what we call a forced reboot now, but what we called in Exchange 2010, a bug check. We are forcibly bug checking the box by terminating WinInet, and that causes it to bug check and reboot, and anytime you reboot a DAG member, that triggers a server failover. So that's how we get ourselves out of this otherwise unrecoverable scenario. So these are the ones that we had in Exchange 2010. In 2013, we've added these new ones. So for instance, the system's in a bad state. No threads can be scheduled, including no managed code threads. If we have a thread halt on a server, pretty much there's only one way to recover from that. That's going to be a forced reboot. It's going to be a bug check of the box to get us out of that situation. Now, it might be that the server comes back and it's right back in that situation, but that is the first thing that you have to try. The next one, long I/O times. If we're seeing a long I/O time, it's taking a while, more than 41 seconds to either send and get back acknowledgement of an I/O or send and we get no acknowledgement of an I/O, again, that's an indication of some sort of storage problem, and we'll go ahead and forcibly bug check the box. The last one, the replication service memory threshold, that's not really a storage issue, but it's up there because the system, again, will take the same type of recovery action. If we see the replication service growing its working set beyond 4 gigabytes, we'll try to restart that and trim its memory that way. If that doesn't correct the problem, or if in trying to restart it, it doesn't restart, we'll forcibly reboot the box and get out of the failure scenario that way. So there are new recovery mechanisms that we have that will handle that for you. Lag copy enhancements. How many of you are using lag copies? A few of you. How many of you are not using them because activating them is too difficult? Oh, not too many. Just a couple of hands went up. Well, this is actually the some of the features that we're bringing in are designed for lag copies to be able to sort of care for themselves. Okay, so in certain situations, you can configure a lag copy to automatically start playing down log files and bring itself up to date. So situations such as a lag copy needs to be page patched. We didn't have page patching for lag copies in 2010. We can do that now in 2013, but of course the lag copy plays itself forward to do that. Low disk space. It's another one that you can turn on. If it's in a low disk space threshold to buy itself some breathing room, a lag copy can start playing playing the logs, and once those logs are played, they're no longer needed and they can be truncated from the system, thereby alleviating your low disk space scenario. And then the last one is if you're in a scenario where you've got replicated databases and one of them is a lag copy, and for any given 24-hour period, you have fewer than, the default is 3, but you can configure it, fewer than 3 healthy copies, That's another scenario that can enable a lag copy to automatically play itself down and bring itself up to an up-to-date, healthy, passive copy as well. But the biggest enhancement I think that we've made is this integration with a feature called SafetyNet. Now, I haven't talked about SafetyNet yet. That's coming up in a little bit. But basically, SafetyNet is the replacement now for Transport Dumpster. Okay, but SafetyNet gives you automatic resubmission. So if I activate a lag copy or if I restore a database from backup, it will automatically re-request missing messages from SafetyNet. Okay, so that integration means there's no more hunting in the log stream for the point at which you want to sever that stream and play forward. I mean, unless you like doing that kind of thing, you can still do that, but you don't have to anymore. Now you can just let the logs play to all the way forward if you want, and then any missing data is automatically recovered for you from the SafetyNet mechanism. I'll talk more about SafetyNet in a bit. First, let's talk about the high availability features that we have, because there are many. We have a whole new high availability monitoring stack called managed availability that I'm going to talk about. We've got database failover changes that are the direct result of having managed availability. And along with that, we also have changes to the best copy selection algorithm that Active Manager does when we do a failover or a target list switchover. We also have a new mode for servers called maintenance mode. It's the way that an administrator can take a machine and pull it out of service to do work on it and then put it back in service when they're done. We also have automatic DAG network configuration. There's very, very little, if anything, you need to do to configure DAG networks anymore. We also have another features in the form of commandlet enhancements that enable all these new scenarios that we didn't have before. And then finally, the last thing that we have are the transport HA enhancements that I'm going to talk about as well. So let's talk about managed availability. The whole idea around managed availability is extending the monitoring and high availability framework outside the DAG into the protocol area. Those of you who are in the architecture session, you know that one, every Exchange server is an island, and two, that all rendering, data access, storage, et cetera, everything associated with a mailbox happens on that one server. Now, what that means, though, is that the protocols for that server aren't available. It doesn't matter how healthy the database is because the protocols are served from that server. So if they're unhealthy, no one's getting in. So that speaks to managed availability and why we extended it outside the DAG to the protocol stack as well. Now, for most problems, we can restart things pretty quickly. For a lot of issues that we're going to have, we'll do things like cycle IIS or restart an application worker pool in IIS or restart a service if necessary. Or if that doesn't correct it, managed availability also has the ability to trigger a database failover now as well, or trigger a server failover by doing something like a forced reboot of a server in response to an unrecoverable error. So, how does it work? This is a very, very basic example of how it works. So we've got our client out there. They're going through the load balancer, hitting a couple CAS servers, and it's an Outlook web app client, so they're using the HTTP protocol. So they send a message through Outlook, and Outlook is working fine. Inside, managed availability is doing its thing. It's doing its thing called probes and responders. Think of these as health sets that check the end-to-end scenario for the users. So a probe might be to actually test the OWA protocol to see if it's up and running. Or it might be something that detects a failure because the OWA protocol is down and now we're not able to collect live data from it and we're not able to issue synthetic transactions to it. So there's a failure that happens and we detect that. Now managed availability comes in and sees that and the first thing it tries to do is restart OWA. Okay, so it'll restart the service in this case, and let's go ahead and say the restart was complete, and OWA came back, as you can see, for mailbox 15, and it's up and running again. Now we verified it's healthy, the user's still using it, and shortly after that, there's another failure again. So here again, managed availability recognized this, detects the failure, tries to restart the service and get things up and running, only this time, the restart of the service failed. For whatever reason, we don't know why, it just failed, it wasn't successful. So this is when managed availability would then trigger a database failover because the protocol stack, the protocol head for that database is gone. And without that, you don't get access to that database. So it doesn't matter that the database is healthy in this case. We still need to fail over to another server because the client access protocols are down on the server we're on. So we fail over. Database comes online on another server. And we verify that it's healthy and life is good for that user again. That's just one of many, many, many examples of how managed availability works. The idea being that stuff breaks, but the experience doesn't. Because it's all built into the system now, and the system knows what's running and what's not running, and more importantly, how to fix things. Now, of course, there will be things that the system can't fix. So just as there's probes and responders, there's also an escalation engine as well. And the escalation engine is very simple. If we can't fix something, we log events into the Crimson Channel, which any event log collection tool can then externalize and alert an administrator. So for instance, if you're using System Center Operations Manager, in System Center, we used to use System Center's logic for our thresholds and whatnot, and root cause and things like correlation. We don't do that anymore. It's all inside of Exchange now. We only use System Center as one of the potential places that can receive these alerts and bubble them up through a UI to the administrator. So System Center, from an Exchange perspective, is no longer the real monitoring tool. It's more of an alerting tool because the monitoring is now built into Exchange itself. And managed availability runs on both server roles. It's running on CAS at all times, and it's running on Mailbox at all times. All right. So what are the things that it gives you? Well, it's a very reliable and scalable framework for doing monitoring at all levels of Exchange. As I said, we do these synthetic transactions that basically simulate all the customer touch points, all the places where an end user would need to interface with. And if any one of these doesn't meet what the experience should be, that's when managed availability can come in and make the corrective action for you. So it's a sequencing mechanism as well. Okay, things are done in a specific and predictable order each time. And they're also throttled and controlled, too. So we understand, for instance, if there's a cascading set of failures that are happening in a DAG, we can go ahead and account for that and not necessarily trigger a database failover for every error. So some of the actions we could do, things like restarting a service. That could involve killing a service and maybe even taking a dump of that service so that you can see what's in the memory and see what it was doing and so forth. Now, that's actually the ability to take dumps is turned off by default in Exchange. We almost had it turned on, but it turns out it's just a little bit too heavy of a mechanism to have turned on. But you do have the option of taking them if you want. App pool restarts, same thing there. Server, that'd be to bug check the machine. If we can't fix the server problem, we'd have to restart it. Failing over things, that's another corrective action that it could take, or marking things as online or offline based on what their status is as well. So for instance, if a CAS is in a really bad state, it could be marked as offline, taken out of rotation from the service standpoint, and then it's up to the administrator to resolve whatever the issue was. And then the last one, which would be the more aggressive, which would be to escalate, notify human because the recovery mechanism is outside the capabilities of the system, and now we need a human to intervene and fix the problem. So we will try to fix as much as we can, but there's going to be places where we'll have to get a human involved to fix some things. Now, single copy alert, how many of you are familiar with that? Okay, so those of you who raised your hand and said you were running a DAG in 2010, all of you should be familiar with that. Go back to your DAGs, look on every single mailbox server that you have, look in the task scheduler, you'll find a task called Database One Copy Alert. We set that up automatically on every mailbox server now, and that is there so that we have a mechanism to alert an administrator when a replicated database is down to one healthy copy. So that was a separate PowerShell script that would run periodically in the task scheduler. We don't have that script anymore. The single copy alert is now natively built into managed availability. Okay, so that just happens automatically out of the box, but we don't need task scheduler to do anything for us, and we don't need to use a PowerShell script. It's done in code now. The alert is also done per server. In 2010, if you had a problem affecting an entire server and that caused multiple databases to go into a single copy condition, we would send you an alert for each database. Now we just send you one for each server, knowing that all the databases on that server will be affected by that outage. It's still triggered across all the machines with copies, so if the database is replicated across four members, we are still checking all four members to see if you're in a single copy condition. And we still generate a notification, and we're still using the same event log numbers and event IDs that we had in 2010. So if you are used to monitoring and collecting this stuff from a 2010 perspective, it works exactly the same way, except you don't have to deal with the script, and you don't have to deal with the task scheduler. The database failover changes, those come in the form of managed availability failovers. And there's basically two types, the database level and the server level. The database level is going to happen, obviously, when only one individual database is affected. But if it looks like all the databases are affected, for instance, the protocol head is down, so we don't have any OWA or ActiveSync or EWS, no protocols are getting in, that could trigger a server failover. And that will cause all the databases that are active on that server to move to one or more other DAG members in doing so. But the new architecture that we have really means we have to be smarter about the way we choose which copy to activate. Because again, because the protocols are served always by the mailbox server hosting the active copy, it's not good enough in Exchange 2013 just to look at the health and status of the database copies, because that doesn't tell us anything anymore as to whether or not those database copies are accessible. The database could be perfectly healthy, but no one could get to it because the protocol is down. So that's not good enough. We have to have a new selection criteria that we use. So what are the selection changes that we made? How many of you are familiar with best copy selection, first of all? Okay, so everybody running a DAG should be intimately familiar with best copy selection because it is the mechanism by which when a failure affects your active copy, that's how Active Manager chooses what database to activate in response to that. That's what we call best copy selection. It's the process for finding the best copy, and we usually put best in quotes there because it's going to be rather subjective based on a variety of factors and the nature of the failure. But it's Active Manager looking for what database should I make the new active database. That's what we're talking about. Now, the inputs are largely the same as what we had in 2010. List all the available copies, give me their health, give me their status, tell me what their content index looks like, and so forth. And in 2010, those were, in fact, the criteria that we used. Copy queue length, replay queue length, database status, and content index status. But again, looking at just those four criteria, that doesn't tell us anything about the server and whether or not it's able to host the protocols. It only tells us if the database is viable for activation. So the criteria that we use in Exchange 2010 simply isn't good enough to use in 2013 because it only tells us half the picture. So now, instead of best copy selection, we now call it best copy and server selection, or BCSS for short. So it's very similar. It's still an Active Manager algorithm, still the replication service doing all the work. We're still using the same criteria that you saw before to check the health and status of the databases. So that would be, again, copy queue length, replay queue length, database status, and content index status. We still use those. But we also now include the health of the entire protocol stack as well. Okay, because we want to make sure that if we fail over, we're not making things worse. So we look at the protocols, and in particular these health sets that they have, and we look at them to see, are they the same as the server we're on? Are they better than the server we're on? Are they worse than the server we're on? Because in fact, when it comes to failover, we have one rule. And that is, do not ever make things worse than what they are. So that's why we're looking at all of the metrics that we can on each server before we go ahead and trigger failover now. So what we've done to enforce that rule is we've added four new criteria to the best copy selection algorithm, and I'm going to list them for you in the order in which they happen. So in the best case scenario, we're looking for another copy on a server that we would consider all healthy. So all healthy means that not only is the database copy that we want to activate in good health, but every other aspect of the server is in good health as well. All the protocols are functioning. All the health sets that have critical or high values, those are all good and online and working. And if we can't find something that meets that, then we'll look for something that is what we call up to normal healthy. And what that means is all the protocol sets that are that have a priority of normal or higher are in a good state. Anything below normal, some low-level protocol, for instance, IMAP or POP might be a lower-level type of protocol health set, we wouldn't evaluate. But as long as the medium and higher are good, we can evaluate and activate. If we can't find something like that, then we're just looking for any server that has a healthy database copy on it whose protocols are in a better situation than the server we're failing over from. So as long as we're in a better place than that server, we would choose this next protocol. And barring that, the last protocol is same as source, which would be basically to fail over to another server that's largely in the same case as the existing server, with the hope that once we get over there, we can try to make things better than it was. But we'll never ever fail over to a place that doesn't at least meet the same criteria as the server that has the current problem. So we will never fail over and make things worse. Maintenance mode. It's one of our favorite features. It's new functionality that you can use to designate a client access server or a mailbox server as in or out of service. So if you ever had to run recover server and get a server back and then reconfigure and whatnot, that's what maintenance mode would be used for. If you're doing some sort of upgrades or maintenance or hardware repair on a client access server, you put it in maintenance mode, and that will tell the load balancer that it's in maintenance mode and not to send client requests there. If you have a mailbox server that you need to do work on, you put it in maintenance mode. That moves all the active copies off, prevents them from coming back, and turns off transport on that server as well. That's maintenance mode, which I think I just described everything. So set server component state, that's a new commandlet in Exchange 2013. That is how you put a server into or take it out of maintenance mode. Out of service from a mailbox perspective means that there's no active databases and transport is completely offline. From a CAS perspective, that means we are bypassing the NLB health check, the health check that the load balancer is doing for service availability, and it means that all proxy services are offline. We won't accept communication and we won't proxy any communication. Now, right now, the NLB health check stuff is not 100% hooked up. We need to work with the load balancing vendors so that they understand the responses they'll get from an Exchange server that's in maintenance mode versus a server that's not in maintenance mode and just having problems responding. So we are working with all the load balancing vendors to get that plumbing hooked up so that when you do buy a load balancer, it will be able to understand the difference between an in-service and an out-of-service Exchange server. All right, and there's also separate tracking mechanisms for this as well, depending on what you're doing with the server. For instance, a server will automatically be put into maintenance mode while setup is running. And if you're doing post-deployment configuration steps, the admin can put it into maintenance mode for those reasons as well. And then, of course, any other repairs or maintenance that you need to do, that is exactly what maintenance mode is for. All right, DAG network enhancements. How many of you have multi-subnet DAGs? All right, how many of you remember to collapse your DAG networks? All right, if you have a multi-subnet DAG, you definitely have to collapse your DAG networks. If you don't in Exchange 2010, we will only replicate over the MAPI network. So look at the documentation. If you haven't done it yet, you definitely want to collapse your networks. But what we've done in 2013 is we made things easier for you. We didn't want you to have to deal too much at the network level. We just really need basic configurations on the NIC themselves. Once you have that basic configuration, then the DAG by default has what we call automatic network configuration turned on. So you do have a choice of turning that off and doing manual configuration, but the default is automatic. And basically, we're doing the same thing. We're looking at the configuration differences, and we're distinguishing between the replication and the MAPI network, and we set that all up for you. In a multi-subnet environment, we will automatically collapse the DAG networks for you, so you don't have to do that anymore. And we'll also make them non-configurable out of the box. If you want to change anything about DAG networks, or even if you want to view DAG network settings inside the user interface, you need to enable manual DAG network configuration to do that. If you don't do that, you'll only be able to see settings from the shell, and you won't be able to change any settings. So what does that look like? Well, if you haven't seen it, this is the Exchange Administration Center. And I have over here, I'm looking at database availability groups. And you can see down here, I've got two DAG networks. I know that's really small, but it says MAPI DAG network and Replication DAG network 01. But I can't click on those. I can't do anything with them because, again, by default, it's an automatic network config. So I have to go into edit the DAG. And down here is this checkbox that says configure database availability group networks manually. So I check this box. Get my mouse back here. We check the box. Click save. And once I've done that, now you can see I've got options under my network. So I can do things like disable replication. I can view the details of that network. I can remove the network if I want to. So if I wanted to look at the details, I would click view details. And I would get, for instance, the MAPI DAG network, which has all the same UI elements that you have seen in the Exchange Management Console. So we have full parity between the old Exchange Management Console and the new Exchange Administration Center, particularly around high availability. And then again, I can also look at the replication network as well, and you can see the similar attributes. All right. But if you don't enable manual configuration, these options under DAG networking won't appear, and you'll have to use the shell to view stuff, and again, you won't be able to configure stuff. All right. Commandlet enhancements, this is really just there to show you that we've got some new parameters for some of the commandlets that you may be used to. The more important ones are going to be the auto DAG and the auto reseed properties that you'll configure for a DAG. And if you want to, that checkbox that you just saw for manual network configuration, that's the equivalent of the manual DAG network configuration property of set DAG. So set that to true, turns manual config off. The default is false, which means it's automatic config. All right. Let's talk about some transport availability changes. So the big change with transport is, unlike before, where we had shadow redundancy that was persisting messages while they were being received by the sending server, and we had transport dumpster that would go ahead and save messages for replicated databases, and we have delayed acknowledgement to delay the acknowledgement of ascending SMTP until we're able to persist it somewhere. We don't do any of that anymore. Instead, we have a mechanism where we redundantly persist every single message that goes through transport. Okay, we're just redundantly persisting it. It's just going to happen. And that's there because we wanted the built-in redundancy in the service. We saw that it provided us with a large number of benefits, particularly a feature like SafetyNet, which makes activating lag copies much easier and recovering missing data much easier. That's why we have these. And resubmits are now also fully automatic. In Transport Dumpster, you had to manually request redelivery. And you only got a few bites of that apple because Transport Dumpster was limited in time and size. Now we don't have a size limit anymore. Now we just have the time limit. And you can set the safety net to be whatever you want it to be. For instance, if you happen to match the safety net retention value with the same amount of days you were having your lag copies, it makes things very, very easy to activate at that point. If you have a lag copy for 7 days, you'll set safety net for 7 days to make sure that you get all of that data back and so forth. So shadow redundancy is still there. It's the same concept that we had in 2010, except the implementation is just slightly different. And in fact, we've got new extensions of shadow redundancy as well. But the idea here is we are redundantly persisting the message on another server. And it could be another server in the same DAG, could be another server in the same site, or if you happen to have a DAG extended across multiple sites, it could be a server in another site, thereby giving you site resilience for transport as well. We also have a new feature called guaranteed redundancy, or the property reject on shadow failure. Now, this one is a little tricky. Basically, what we're saying here is that if we cannot redundantly persist the message somewhere else in the organization, we are not going to accept that message in the first place. We will reject it because we can't shadow it anywhere. Now, if you use this feature, we strongly recommend that you have a minimum of 4 mailbox servers, 4 transport servers, if you will. The reason for that is, think about it, in a 2-server environment, you've only got 2 places where the message can go in. So if you have a 2-member DAG, for instance, and one of those members is down, and you had this feature turned off, well, we don't have another place to make that message redundancy. And as a result of that, transport stops accepting messages. So 2 is not good enough. Now, you could go to 3, but you could still be in that same situation. You've got one server that may be down for maintenance, and now you have an unexpected failure of another server. Again, you're right back in that situation. But our strong feeling is if you have 4 servers, that then gives you the breathing room, so one could be down for maintenance, and another one could unexpectedly fail, and you still have 2 servers left. So you still have the ability to have redundant transport. If you don't have at least 4 servers, don't turn this feature on because, again, once that redundancy is gone, it will stop accepting all messages. So just be aware of that. And then safety net. I've talked about it a few times. Safety net was actually a mechanism we first introduced in Office 365. It was yet a third mechanism we were using outside of transport dumpster, outside of shadow redundancy, to persist messages. And of course, we really don't need all those different places, particularly in the on-premises product. So we've consolidated down to just shadow redundancy and safety net. So safety net is the replacement for transport dumpster. If you go searching through the 2013 documentation, the only time you'll see a reference to transport dumpster is the sentence that says safety net is the replacement for transport dumpster. Otherwise, we don't call it that anymore. It's all safety net there. And safety net now has a shadow equivalent as well. So unlike transport dumpster, where the messages were only in one place at any given time, we have redundancy through safety net because we're redundantly persisting the messages somewhere else as well. So it's no longer a single point of failure like we had in 2010. All right. The last section I want to talk about over the last 16 minutes or so is site resilience. Now, how many of you already have your DAG extended to multiple data centers? All right. So in 2010, we spent a lot of time, wrote a lot of content, wrote a lot of blogs, spent a lot of time at conferences, talking to people about the specific way to do things in 2010. And part of the reason that we told them to do things a certain way is basically because of the architecture that we had in 2010 largely forced us down that path. So in 2010, for example, we could give you a database failover, we could give you a server failover, but we never had this concept of what's called a data center failover, where if you lost, you know, half your DAG in one data center, or if you lost all of your CAS in one data center, you didn't have everything automatically switched over. You had to manually switch over using some steps for the DAG and a separate set of steps for the non-mailbox server roles. You can still do that today with X 2013, so things haven't changed too much. But we do give you some options. One of the big things that we've done is we've made site resilience operationally much more simple than what we had in 2010. And by that, I mean the recovery process. It's much, much simpler. And one of the reasons it's simpler is because we've separated CAS and mailbox recovery. Okay, in 2010, they're coupled together. The namespace, even though it might be on different servers, still goes with the DAG in 2010. So you move the namespace over, you're taking the DAG with it. You move the DAG over, you're taking the namespace with it. You didn't have this separation like we do in 2013. And more importantly, and this is an interesting piece of irony, in 2010, arguably the biggest single point of failure we have in the entire 2010 topology, if you will, is the namespace. Because when you think about it, it's the namespace that tells the user where to go. And if that where to go has to change, well, now you're talking DNS changes. You're talking DNS latency and convergence, which in some parts of the world is nowhere near as good as it is here and in the U.S. and other parts. In some parts, it's very bad to have to deal with that. Okay, so now we've got a mechanism where you don't have to do that because the namespace provides the redundancy at the client level. So I say things are operationally simplified. What do I mean by that? Well, previously in 2010, if I lose the CAS, enough of them, or if I lose the CAS array, or if I lose the virtual IP on top of that, or if I lose the load balancer, or if I lose some portion of the DAG, now it was up to the administrator to go ahead and do the work to do the recovery. The administrator had to manually switch the data and services and namespace over to another data center. They had to do that work, and it was a manual operation that could take hours and, in some cases, days, depending on the nature of the failure and how quickly they could react to it. 2013, recovery happens automatically, which means the administrator spends their time working on whatever the core problem was, not restoring service. And any of you who've been administrators for any period of time, you know that the amount of stress that you're under when you need to restore service is very different from the type of stress when you're just repairing a failed piece of equipment. I'd rather work on the failed piece of equipment than have the CEO breathing down my neck while I try to restore service. The admin focuses on fixing the issue instead of restoring service because the service is restoring itself automatically now. Previously, CAS and mailbox were tied together. Even if you had them on separate roles, because CAS provided the namespace and mailbox provided the data, you couldn't recover one without the other. Well, you could, but you'd be changing namespaces or losing data. So they were tied together. They were tightly coupled. In 2013, recovery is independent. We don't have to recover CAS just because the DAG is having a problem. We don't have to recover the DAG just because CAS is having the problem. Recovery is now happening independently, and in many cases, it's happening automatically. Automatically from the DAG perspective, and automatically from the client and namespace perspective. And the trick is, we're leveraging the ability of modern HTTP clients to simply use multiple DNS addresses. So I query for mail.contoso.com, and instead of getting one IP address back, I get two back, or maybe three. And now I can load balance between them. If one of them fails, all modern HTTP clients, when they have a hard TCP failure, they wait 20 seconds. Then they try the next address in their list. They automatically fail over by themselves. So redundancy is built into the namespace now. It doesn't need to be built in at the server side. It's built in on the client side using the built-in redundancy that these clients have. Admins can still do a switchover. If you wanted to do a switchover, now you're going into DNS and removing one of those IP addresses. And eventually, connections will taper off and disappear as that IP address is no longer handed out. So you still have the ability to intervene and do switchovers if you want to, but now you also have the ability for the system to have automatic failover for you, including data center failovers. And because you've got multiple IP addresses pointing to the namespace now is no longer a single point of failure. And because you have multiple IP addresses pointing to the same namespace, you don't have to change DNS in order for failover to happen. It just happens. And because DNS isn't being changed, there's no DNS latency that you have to deal with as well. The only latency that your clients will experience is the built-in 20-second change for when one IP address dies and before the other one is tried. So what used to be 45 minutes to an hour to 2 hours to 3 hours to do a data center switchover, now it's a data center failover and the clients are back online in 20 seconds or less. Much, much better experience. So, you lose the load balancer in the primary? No problem. Failover to another VIP automatically. Again, the admin doesn't have to restore service. The service restores itself. The admin fixes the dead load balancer. The admin deals with replacing the failed equipment instead of restoring service. Again, the stress on that admin is much less and much different in that scenario. No DNS latency. And automatic failover for CAS plus automatic failover for mailbox equals the unicorn, the data center failover. So, what does that look like? Well, let's look at it from the CAS perspective first. So, here I've got two data centers, Redmond and Portland. I've got a CAS array here and a CAS array there. I've got my two VIPs, 192.168 and 10.vip. When a client resolves mail.contoso.com, that client will get back both addresses. Okay? And if that one goes away, the client will automatically fail over to another one. There's nothing that the administrator has to do. Now, if they want, the administrator can do what I've done on the slide and go into DNS and take that failed VIP out of DNS. And that way, that'll prevent clients from having that hard stop and that 20-second failover. And that's another mechanism whereby they can take a machine out of service. But it's that simple. They get failover automatically, and while the administrator fixes the problem, at their desire, they can go ahead and remove that IP from DNS. They don't have to, but it makes things more convenient for them. Then later on, when they fix the problem, they put it back in DNS, and the load balancing and round robin will continue with the newly added IP address. Now, let's look at the mailbox server side. Now, the mailbox server, the actual behavior you'll get will depend on the number of sites to which you've extended your DAG. Now, in 2010, we spent a lot of time telling customers that moving from 2 to 3 data centers was not going to buy you anything. And it's still true for 2010. It won't buy you anything because the namespace is tied to the DAG. Recovery of CAS is tied to recovery of the DAG and vice versa. And even if you were to do something like put the witness in another data center, it wouldn't always guarantee you the behavior that you wanted because it only affected the DAG. It didn't do anything with the non-mailbox roles. So if you follow that path and you go for 2 data centers with Exchange 2013, you get a very similar experience. You lose your primary data center. It causes your other DAG members to go down. And so you do these 3 steps, and now you've activated the DAG. And once you're done with that, you end up with something that looks like this. 2 surviving DAG members and an alternate witness server. Okay? But it's a much quicker process here. Even though it's still a manual process in this example, it's much quicker because you're only dealing with the mailbox role, which means there's only 3 steps, just the 3 steps that you see up here to do the activation. You don't have to worry about the front end because that's separate. You only need to deal with activating the DAG in this case. Let's take this one step further, though. Let's say you actually have 3 sites and you've decided that you want to leverage them. Well, with the namespace simplification, with the consolidation of server roles so that now we only have the 2 to deal with separation of CAS array and DAG from a recovery and functionality standpoint, decoupling of CAS and mailbox from the AD site perspective, with the load balancing changes, all that stuff means that with 3 locations, if you have them available, you can now get automatic failover for your DAG. And the scenario I just described before, where it's all manual, doesn't need to exist. It can be completely and fully automatic. Now, obviously to do this, 3 sites requires 3 locations. I'm not telling you to go out and get a 3rd location. Okay, don't do that. If you don't already have 3 locations, you won't be able to take advantage of this. Don't go get a 3rd location just so you can do this. From the cost of goods perspective, it's not worth it. But if you happen to have 2 very well-connected locations where you can place the Exchange servers, say, for instance, a primary and standby data center, and if you happen to have maybe a less well-connected branch office where you could just have a server there acting as your witness server, that's a great topology to have. Now, when we talk about branch office and having a server there, I don't mean, you know, some server sitting on someone's desk in an office. It still has to be a, you know, operationally manageable type of server. It's got to be something that is within the visibility of the Exchange administrator because it is the witness server and it would be part of the solution. But it doesn't have to be a beefy server and it doesn't need the same kind of networking that the Exchange infrastructure needs. The Exchange sites must be well connected. The witness site does not need to be well connected. But it does, however, need to be isolated from any network failures or any power failures that can affect your 2 other sites. As long as you have that isolation, you'll get the predictable behavior of failover each and every time. So what does that look like? It's very simple when you have three sites. Here again, I've got the same DAG that I had before extended across the two sites, except I now have a third data center in Paris. And in fact, we really like the idea of having that third site be on a different continent. We do that explicitly in Office 365 just for geo-redundancy purposes. So in this case, Redmond and Portland, they're on the North American continent, but I've got my witness server over there in Europe, and again, it doesn't need to be very well connected. So same scenario, I lose the DAG in my primary data center. Now in this case, I've got a third site. There's nothing for the administrator to do. Assuming that 3 and 4 are operating normally and that one of them can reach out and lock the witness, you get data center failover. You get automatic failover for the DAG in this case. And because the namespace doesn't need to move with the DAG, everything will just continue working from the end user perspective. And of course, if something went wrong, maybe the witness server wasn't there or the timing was such that networking happened to be down to Paris, then you just do the same three steps that you saw on the other slide, and you manually activate the DAG, and you're done. Still a very quick operation, even if you have to back off and do a manual one. All right, believe it or not, that was about 75 minutes. And I know your heads are swimming right now because of all the new stuff I just threw at you. This deck will be available for download. It should be there now. They've already uploaded it. This session is being recorded. I would recommend watching it a few times because there's a lot of new stuff in here. I'm also going to have some blogs that are coming out over the next few weeks that are going to talk about largely all the stuff I talked about. And, of course, we've got some of the stuff, not all of it, in the product documentation that's out there on TechNet right now. So you'll definitely want to check out the track resources. Don't forget to fill out your evals as well. That's super important. And then hopefully one of you will go and play with the flight simulator and maybe even win that chair as well, provided, of course, you're wearing your office shirt so that you can play in the first place. All right. And with that, I know we just have a few seconds left, but I'm happy to entertain any questions that anyone might have. Thank you. Thank you. Let's start back there. Yes, sir. So the question is, when we've got a DAG across two sites, what happens if you lose the link between those sites? Right. So in that case, if you only have two sites, then you've got what we would consider the primary with the majority of voters and the secondary or standby with the minority of voters. You get the same behavior that you'd have in 2010, which is the minority side loses quorum and terminates, and the majority side stays up and running. Yes, sir. Sure, so the question is, with managed availability, when one of the responders goes in and restarts the services, is there a maximum time that we'll wait or maximum number of tries? Yes. So yes to both. Yeah, we recognize that if we restart a service and then it's crashed right away, we might try, depending on the service, one or two more times to do that. And if we catch that we're in this loop where restart, crash, we'll then go ahead and managed availability will escalate its responders and eventually invoke a database failover responder, get the active databases off that server, and then try to correct it through maybe a forced reboot, or if that doesn't work, through escalation and notifying an administrator. So there is some smarts in there where we know when to give up and increase and escalate to a higher level of recovery. Sure, so what about setting the priority of that? So you cannot manipulate the priority of the health sets. We hard code that, but we do give you the ability to do things like disable the probes for a health set or change some of the thresholds that we would use because every environment's going to be a little bit different and the thresholds aren't going to apply equally to all environments. Most of the default settings we have for the managed availability probes will work in most environments, but we do give you the ability to change those probes. So like for instance, if you're in a lab environment, I usually go ahead and ratchet them way up so that they're not going to do anything when I'm doing something on my lab servers. In a production environment, you wouldn't want to do that because that could allow all these bad things to happen without recovery taking place. But in a lab environment, you definitely want to tweak them. Now, in a production environment, if you find that you're trying to do a normal activity, like you're moving a mailbox between servers, and in the process of moving that mailbox, maybe the target server starts seeing services restarting or starts rebooting itself. That's most likely managed availability responding to threshold or resource pressure on there and throttling it back. So that might be another scenario where you need to go in and tweak some of those settings to account for the workload that you're doing on that server. But by and large, the out-of-box settings should work very reasonably in almost all environments, small to large. All right, who's next? Yes, sir. Sure. So the question is, you pull a disk and that triggers auto reseed, but the admin pulled the wrong disk and so they try to throw it back in. Once you pulled that disk out, it's going to be dead from the operating system standpoint. And so that would cause auto reseed to grab a spare, allocate it, map it, and start doing its thing. Even if you put the disk back in and as if by magic Windows could re-recognize it, that operation's already ongoing. At that point, we've already considered that disk to be dead, and so we wouldn't recognize that it came back to life. Once we consider the disk dead, because it's only those two conditions that we're looking for, it's dead. There's no scenario in which we believe a disk would ever come back to life in that scenario. So even if you put it back in, it's not going to stop auto-reseed. It's not going to undo any operations that it's already done. And basically, if it really is a good disk, then it'd be up to the administrator simply to format it and put it in the spare pool versus putting it in an in-use storage volume. Try not to pull the wrong disk, though. Yeah, I know it happens, but try not to do that. All right. Anything else? Well, if you can't think of anything again, tomorrow and Friday, I'll be at the speaker lounge from 11 to 11:30. I think I saw a hand go up back here. Yes. Yes. Sure. So in the bailiwick of auto reseed, we use disk and volume interchangeably because it should really be, you know, one partition per disk, thus one volume per disk. But again, you could use this in a non-JBOT environment, and so you might be looking at different scenarios. Now, if you're just in a DAS scenario and you're using RAID, then auto reseed isn't going to do anything for you because it's not going to detect the loss of any databases when a RAIDed disk goes away. That's the whole point of RAID. But if you're using DAS in a JBOT environment, then yes, it will do just that. All right. Anything else? Yes, way up at the top. You have to say that a little louder. Is there some way to set site affinity? Yes. So there are DNS solutions that are what you would call geo-DNS solutions, and they hand out sets of IP addresses that are based on the IP address of the client doing the query. So if I'm in North America and I query that DNS solution, I get back IP addresses for somewhere in North America. If I'm traveling and I'm out in APAC, for example, and I query for that same name, I'm going to get IP addresses for the APAC region if they exist. So that would be a GeoDNS type of solution that you would use. If the APAC goes down, well, then you could end up having a problem. If you are using GeoDNS and you segregate it such that you're only handing out addresses for that region, if that region goes away, then you're going to have to go in and change DNS to hand out IP addresses for the surviving regions. Well, the client can fail over, but it's only going to fail over to IP addresses that it already has, which means that you'd have to be handing out IP addresses for multiple regions in order for it to fail over across regions. And you can do that. That was the first example that I showed with just the single simple worldwide namespace where we're handing out all the IPs no matter where you're coming from. If you want to isolate things, that's when you would use the GeoDNS solution and limit the IPs to just that region, knowing that if that entire region went away, the admin would have to make a DNS change to include IPs from the surviving regions. So you could do that. You could put all regions in there as well and know that users are going to bounce around between both regions. But their mailbox is only going to be in one place, so it almost doesn't really matter which CAS server they're hitting anywhere, because whatever CAS they hit, it's going to proxy back to their mailbox server. So that is generally a reasonable type of approach. There are some customers who are just fine to allow the traffic to just do its own thing like that, knowing that the end user experience is going to be so much better as a result of that. Right, exactly. All right, any other questions? Yes, sir. Is the GeoDNS capabilities available in Windows 2012 DNS server? I don't know. Excellent question. Figure you'd be the one to stump me. I will look that up and I will let you know. I don't know. I don't think so, because if it were, everybody in Exchange would probably be in a lather about it. So I'm guessing no, but I will double check on that for you. All right. That's it for me. I got to get out of here. Thank you very much. If you have any other questions, 11 to 11:30 tomorrow and Friday, and also the deployment and coexistence session on Friday as well. Thank you very much.